Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 24. I'm going to read a few verses from there. I'm going to try to tie up what we're saying from the beginning of Hebrews with later things, because it does, of course, all tie together. So for our reading, Hebrews 9:24. For Christ has entered, not into a sanctuary made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy place yearly with blood not his own, for then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for men to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Now let's turn to Hebrews chapter 1 as we get into our series. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3b is where we are today, and it'll be quite enough work for us to look at these couple of lines. Halfway through verse 3 of Hebrews 1, when he, that is Jesus, had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Like the railways, we're running a little late in our series, I'm afraid, because of circumstances outside our control. And I must be honest, it's partly circumstances that I can't stop talking, and we haven't got far enough. But it's also the snow, which means that if you do have a blue card, we've got as far as the second talk, although it is the third one. Hopefully we'll catch up. Now, for the writer to the Hebrews, the Christian life is always thought of quite consistently through his 13 chapters as a journey. That is, as the progress of a pilgrim from the city of destruction to the celestial city. John Bunyan got part of his inspiration from this particular letter. And the writer is not just describing a journey, a walk, or a race. He wants us to run it with patience and make it to the end, so that the letter is full of warnings to those who might not reach heaven. And indeed, the title for our series is taken from verse 3 of chapter 2, which is on the same page, so you can glance at it now, when he asks the question, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? He's talking about this salvation, which is primarily future, reaching the end of the journey, and he longs for us to reach it. Now, it's difficult to make a journey if there are patches of fog, as I discovered last Friday. Indeed, it can be quite frightening to enter a patch of fog and not know where you're going. And my job on a Tuesday, as I understand it, is to remove the fog so that people know where they're going if they want to take this journey from the city of destruction to heaven. Last night, I had forgotten where I reached last Tuesday, so I went into the tape library and borrowed the tape of last week. And I was conscious of the fact that I'd explained certain difficulties very badly, and what a lot of fog I'd left behind. Indeed, I was really rather humbled and ashamed by it. And I really regard you as very polite that you don't come up to me afterwards and say, what on earth did you say that for, or what on earth did you mean by that? You ought to have done last week. Perhaps I was trying too hard. It's said that a perfectionist is one who takes great pains and gives them to others. And if I did that last Tuesday, then I apologize. Now, to recapitulate how far we've got, the great statement we've looked at so far is in verses 1 and 2 that God has spoken, and that is thrilling news. To anybody who's been brought up to believe that this is a rather agnostic kind of universe, it's marvelous to know that God has spoken, and spoken clearly. And what he says here is that he's spoken by a son, verse 2, though I suppose we might also say that he has spoken about a son. Hebrews is rather like one of the Gospels. It tells us all about Jesus Christ, who he was and what he came to do. I'm not sure that it's quite as good a book to give to an inquirer as one of the Gospels, but it is a book to give to an inquirer if they will pay attention to it and work at it. It's a great book because it tells us about that son, and therefore, if we read it carefully, we shall hear God speaking to us. That's the way, by the way, to hear God speaking. If you happen to have dropped in this morning and you don't know, it's to start reading about his son. Now, everything about that son that he wants to say in the 13 chapters of this book is summarized in these four verses, which is why we're taking such a long time to get out of them. There are two things only, however, of supreme worth in these four verses. First, he says about his son that he's a revealer of God. And secondly, he says about his son that he's a redeemer of men. We've looked at the first already, now we come to the second. Jesus as a redeemer of men is described in verse 3b. Just a word about these two, because they are married very closely in the New Testament. To be a revealer of God means that Jesus brings us the truth about God. To be a redeemer of men means that he gives us an experience of God. And we can promise both these to you if you pay attention to what is said on Tuesday morning. It may seem a bold thing to say, but we can, because this is not our word, but God's. If you pay attention to what is said on Tuesday, in the end you will discover the truth about God. That is enough truth to have an experience of God. You won't know all the answers, but you will come to know enough about God to experience his love and to know him. Let me just put those two again before you. Understanding of truth leads to experience. It's bound to. But conversely, when you have that experience of God, it will lead you back to a clearer understanding. These two work together. My job is to teach so that people understand about God, and that ought to lead them to an experience of God. And when it does, then they themselves come to a clearer understanding of God. And what happens, and it's a great delight to me, is they say to me, perhaps after a lunch hour service or some other time, "Now at last I know what you've been driving at all this time." And what is even more delightful is when they start telling me the Christian faith and saying, "You ought to have said this and you oughtn't to have said that." You see, when a person has had an experience of God, then they've got something to say. You haven't got something to say when you've only got an understanding. That's why theology by itself can be sterile. It's an understanding that leads us to an experience that gives us something to say. Have you got something to say? It's a very good test as to whether you're a real Christian. A real Christian may be very shy and tongue-tied, but they've got something to say. Well, now let's get down to this matter of Christ then as a redeemer in this verse. I was very much helped by a student at the weekend. I've been at a Christian medical student's weekend, and it's really quite a frightening experience to be amongst hundreds of doctors to be for a weekend. They had a party on the Saturday night and about 15 sketches, and I didn't understand the jokes in any of them. They were all medical jokes, which are very in talk. I'm quite glad I didn't. I probably fainted on the spot if I had. Now, let's get on with this. One of the students said to me, he's the kind of preacher who opens the Bible, reads the text, then shuts the Bible and tells you what he thinks it means. It's very easy to be that kind of preacher with this sentence. When he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. I could shut the Bible and tell you what I think that means, because I have preached on it before. But it seems to me the preacher's sacred duty is to draw your attention to the verse and show you what the original writer was emphasizing, what I suppose would be in red ink or in color if he were present here. So let me tell you what I think are the three words or phrases that he wants to underline in this very simple verse. The first is the personal pronoun he. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down. I think the writer wanted you to realize right from the start who he was talking about. That's why you get all this about the person of Jesus in verse 2 that I can't go back into now, these tremendous statements about Jesus creating the world, and then the tremendous statements about Jesus in verses 5 to 13, where he goes on listing all the glorious things about the person of Christ, that we're to worship him, that he's the eternal king, that he's our creator. Now, you see, he makes verse 3 follow verse 2, because he wants us to know that the one who made purification for sins is the one who created the world. A great deal hangs on that. Let me illustrate in a rather silly illustration, but it may help. There are two men who work near here. Their Christian names are Peter and Robin. I only know the first by his Christian name, and that is Peter, who is our paper man. He's one of the characters in these parts. He has a lot to say. Many people stop as they buy their standard for a chat. Many people respond to his shouts. Some people are frightened when he chases them off if they park their car in the wrong place. When he comes to bring me my evening paper, he always tells me something about the news and gives me his slant. Yes, he's a great character. But when Peter talks, a great deal outside, we can hear him, and when he comes in and talks to the office staff, none of what he says will reach the papers tomorrow morning. No journalist is on hand to take it down. However, there's another man called Robin. I don't know him by his Christian name, because he's the governor of the Bank of England, Robin Lee Pemberton. And last night he had something to say about affairs, and it was immediately put down in the paper, and we read it this morning about the scandals in the city. Peter talks about the scandals in the city, and nobody listens. Robin Lee Pemberton talks about them, and everybody listens. Well, obviously, it depends on who's talking. So you see, this writer wants to make it plain to us that this purification of sins is not done by the carpenter of Nazareth or the Messiah of the Jews, but the creator of the world, and the significance of that I want to come on to. Not only shows that the action is very important, but it shows that we are very important. If the Prime Minister was to visit a school today, that school might have a life of its own, but be completely unknown to most people. Life actually in school is pretty narrow, isn't it? School teachers can become rather narrow. It's a little world of its own. And it may feel that nobody cares about it, least of all the local education authority won't give it any money, or whatever it may be. And then one day the Prime Minister comes, and the next day the Minister of Education comes, and the next day the leader of the opposition comes, and the next day Mr. Steele comes, and the people in the school say, well, quite clearly, we're important now. Education is on the top of the political map. Now, you see, if God comes into the world, if that is the one who is controlling the world, comes into our little world, what he tells us by that is that it's important what's going on in our little world. And if what he does is described to us in these words, we ought to pay attention, because it must be what he thinks our world needs. So you see, the writer's prepared the way. He wants us to know that this isn't a small thing, that the creator of the world has come into the world, and if you wanted to summarize in one sentence what the great creator had done for the world, it can be put in one way: he has made purification for sins. That matters. Let me try to tell you what I'm getting at, in case I may be making heavy weather of it. You see, as I understand, the people who don't come to St. Helens in the lunch hour are not Christians. They think, and a lot of young people are coming into the city, they think that our concerns, who meet here and preach and talk to one another, are very narrow. They feel that we're interested in religion. They want, as they call it, life. They say, look at all the world offers us. We don't need a faith. These people who come to Tuesdays, they say, they're retreating from reality. We know where we're going without all that. You can live a happy life without all that business of a Bible and prayers and so on. In other words, Satan is always trying to make religion a little thing on its own, like the school that I illustrated just now. Nothing very much to do with the world around. But you see, by putting all these things together, what our writer is doing is he's saying what Jesus did in the world has a great deal to do with the whole universe, because the one who did it is the one who started it all going, and the one to whom it's all going to belong at the end, and the one who's sustaining it in the middle. And this great mighty God saw that the one thing that was needed in the world was that purification should be made for sins. And therefore, if such a great one tells us that, then that must be the thing that we need, that the world desperately wants, if it is to make sense. And that's what our claim is, isn't it? We are not talking about a narrow interest. We're talking about the world. We're talking about the life that the Creator gave us. We can't live that properly without purification of sins. It's not a marginal thing. Terribly important for us to remember that, to try to see that our churches don't look as though they're clubs for people with a special interest, but that what we have to say is for the world. We had a doctor at this conference. It was most interesting. He said that when he graduated, he decided to join a practice of non-Christian doctors. Now, he may or may not have been wise about that. Most Christian doctors love to be in a practice with Christian doctors. But he said, no, I determined to join a non-Christian practice. Because he said, I feel all the time I'm getting out of touch with the world, and I want to be in the world to show that this is relevant to the world. That's what our author is getting at. Now, secondly, I must go more quickly. Let's look at the next phrase. The next phrase he would have underlined is the phrase purification for sins. Now, that little phrase is a tremendous giveaway. It's an Old Testament phrase. It's Old Testament language. It comes from temple priests and sacrifice, and it's central to Judaism. So you see, as he writes that down, what he is saying is that Jesus did what the temple and the sacrifice and the priests were trying to do. Now, God gave the temple, the priest, and the sacrifices to Judaism, not in order to keep them busy on Sunday, or rather the Sabbath. He gave the people these things in order to bring them to know him and to love him. Someone took me to task for saying that Judaism was a failure. They were quite right. Judaism came from God. If it failed, it wasn't because Judaism, what God gave, was a failure. It was because men were a failure. But there was something incomplete, wasn't there, in Judaism? In the end, it wasn't going to meet a world's need. And what the writer to the Hebrews is saying is that Jesus has come to bring all these things that God gave through Judaism and offer them to the whole world in completeness and in truth. In other words, all that was foreshadowed by Judaism comes to completion and fulfillment and reality at the cross of Christ. And it is there that all the world can come to know God. That's the place of meeting. The place of meeting with God is not church, it's not kneeling by your bedside, it's not meditation. The place to meet God is by the cross of Christ. That's the only place we meet him. See, and that's why we can be religious and never meet him. It's very frustrating to meet somebody and go to the wrong place, isn't it? I think I've told you before of our two Davids, David McInnes, when he was a curate here. He went on his day off to meet David Watson, his great friend, at Birmingham in the days when there were two stations at Birmingham. They agreed to meet at the station. One was on one station platform and the other was on the other station a mile away. And they were there all day, and then they went home and wrote each other a very cross letter. Very frustrating day. You need to know exactly where to meet, don't you? And this is telling us where to meet. Don't go to the temple anymore. Go to Christ. And then finally, he's at great pains to show that having done this, Jesus had nothing else on earth to do and he returned to God. He went home. That's why he says at the end, he sat down at the right hand of God. And the sat down has the force of saying he'd finished his work. That's tremendous, isn't it? He'd finished the work of atonement. There's nothing else that Christ is going to do. All the other things that have to be done in the world, like sorting out Gulf Wars and feeding people in famine areas, that's not Christ's work, that's ours. All those things we are capable of doing, even though we don't do them. We are incapable of bringing ourselves back to God. We're incapable of preparing ourselves for heaven. That is what he came to do, and when he'd done it, he went back to heaven because he'd done the only thing that was necessary. Many of you will know of Alan Cook's death, our very good friend and neighbor at St. Peter's Cornhill. He was a very faithful pastor, and I'd like to pay tribute to him. He was certainly a very good friend to me. And he was taken ill very quickly just before Christmas and died last week, or 10 days ago. I went to see him in hospital. The doctor had given him a kind but clear warning, but he was quite at peace. In fact, he was on tremendous form. ordering me about the war to go and tell other people the gospel, which is not exactly what I'd gone for. However, I was told to do it. Now, Alan had made the great discovery long ago that his job was not to rush around offering sacrifice for sins. That was the great Reformation discovery, wasn't it? That's not the minister's job. He's not a priest offering sacrifices. Now, if the work has been finished, the priestly work, what is then the minister's job? It's to go around telling people about this great finished work, this great achievement. And that is what Alan spent his life doing, and we thank God for him. You'll find on your sheets that I've said something about that finished work, and I'll leave you to read that because there isn't time now. But that's what our writer wants us to know, that God Almighty did this work, and therefore the world cannot exist without this work being done. That if God came to do it, it must be of supreme importance for everybody. But that when he had done it, he did the thing that he could do and that no man could do, and that he sent his son to do it, who then returned to his father triumphant, having finished that work. That's the gospel, isn't it? And therefore you should have something to tell people, if you understand that. We thank you, Heavenly Father, that you sent your son to be a revealer and a redeemer. We thank you that when he had done this work, he returned to your throne on high. Thank you, therefore, that we know quite clearly what our work is, to tell other people of his work. And we do pray for the city, that many may come to hear it this year of 1987. Touch our lips, touch our hearts, make us useful witnesses for Christ, for his name's sake. Amen.